your word and the life that we have this day. We pray that you help us during this day to appreciate the gifts that you give and to use them in your service. In Jesus' name, amen. We've now arrived at chapter 7, and we don't have time to cover, obviously, from 7 to 12 in 1 hour if we are going to deal with all of it. So we have to pick and choose.
What book?
Oh, the Gospel of John, chapter 7. And this is the third time that Jesus is going to Jerusalem. According to John, he went to Jerusalem 3 times, and he spent the rest of the time in his home territory. But Jesus moves around a good bit more in the Gospel of John than he does according to the synoptics. And it's possible to harmonize them, but it's not easy. And so at this point, he's going up to the Feast of Tabernacles, which was the feast that occurred in the fall of the year. At the Feast of Tabernacles, called in Hebrew Sukkoth, was the time when they prayed for rain. They prayed for the possibility that they would have enough rain so that they could have a crop that year. And so everyone would gather, as many as could, and they would go through an elaborate ceremony. And one of the things they did was to take water from the pool at Siloam and carry it ceremoniously through the city up to the mount, up to the Temple Mount, and throw it on the altar as a prayer, an acted-out prayer, that in fact there would be rain that year. You realize that it's a desperate situation. Every year they have to pray and hope for rain, because if they don't get it, they probably won't have any food. And so they live much closer to the realities of life and death than we do. Now, people in California recently are concerned because they haven't had very much rain recently. And in Pennsylvania, where we are, we've had a very dry summer. And so we are concerned. But it's nothing like what they have there, and they have it all the time. So you have to recognize that water is very, very precious. And they are very concerned every year to be sure that they have enough water. One of the things they do at the Feast of Tabernacles is to build a little shelter. Every faithful Jew builds a little shelter on the top of his house, and he puts some, or her house, and puts some palm branches or something over the top of their little shelter to simulate what it was like to go through the wilderness wanderings. That is, they reenact that spirit of what happened in the early days, in a sense reliving the beginning of their country. And they continued to do that down to today. So the Feast of Tabernacles was a time to remember the past and to hope for something into the future. You notice that if you read carefully in chapter 7, we're not going to take time to read it out loud, that Jesus says he's not going to go. His brothers encourage him to go, but he says, no, I won't go at this time. And then later he goes up, and it says he went up as well, but quite privately, without drawing attention to himself, in verse 10. In other words, he's trying to minimize his arrival and not put himself in the limelight and draw attention to himself, because he recognizes that there is a lot of controversy swirling around him, and he needs to move carefully so that he doesn't unnecessarily antagonize his enemies. And during the ceremony then, during the service, he says in verse 37, on the last and greatest day of the festival, so at a dramatic time in the time of the festival, Jesus stood there and cried out, "If any man is thirsty, let him come to me. Let the man come and drink who believes in me. as Scripture says, from his breast shall flow fountains of living water. That is, from the center of his life, from the heart, from the bowels. I mean, they believed that the center of life was here in the middle of the body rather than the heart. And so they spoke of the breast or the belly as the place where the water would flow from. He was speaking of the Spirit which those who believed in him were to receive, for there was no Spirit as yet, because Jesus had not yet been glorified. And this must have been a dramatic scene, you know, with hundreds and maybe thousands of people around. He suddenly stands up and says, you know, if anyone is thirsty, come to me, and I will give you life, and out of him will come living water. Another thing that happens during that festival is the sense in which large containers of oil, probably olive oil, are set out prominently in the area around the temple, and they are lighted at night, and they make a huge flame that shoots up to the sky and can be seen for a long distance. And he says at that point, I am the light of the world. Anyone who follows me will not be walking in the dark. He will have the light of life, in chapter 8, verse 12. And so what he does is to take the symbols that are there, okay, the water, and now in this case, the light, and to use them to symbolize himself and to say, in effect, I am the light of the world. And in a sense, then, he's replacing this festival. He is saying, you don't need to use this festival anymore, because in me you have enough. So he's replaced Jacob, he's replaced Moses, he's replaced the law, he's replaced the temple, and now he's replacing this festival. So one after the other, he's taking the institutions that were very real to the Jews and saying, these are fulfilled in me, and I can replace all of these things. So he, in a dramatic way, he's sharing his gifts with everyone. And of course, some believe and some don't. And that's the way it is. Now let's take a look at chapter 8. Would someone read for us chapter 8, verse 1 down to 11? Okay?
Right. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives early in the morning. He came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst of them, they said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such. What do you say about her? This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground, and as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. And once more, he bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away, one by one, beginning with the eldest. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus looked up and said to her, Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She said, No one, Lord. And Jesus said, Neither do I condemn you. Go and do not sin again.
Okay. You have to know that in the very, very earliest manuscripts, apparently, this was not included. So this is a event in Jesus' life which was added after the first manuscripts were distributed. But we don't have any of those manuscripts. All that we have include the story. And the reason they put it in, of course, is that this is a very typical story. This is so expressive of Jesus' mercy and his love. But the early church apparently was afraid that Jesus would come across as too lenient and too easy on people. And therefore, they were reluctant to tell the story. But they quickly realized, apparently, after some months or years, that this needed to be said, because this is so typical of Jesus and his spirit. The other thing to say is that the scribes and the Pharisees apparently set her up. That is, this was a trumped-up charge, almost what you would call a lynching. And they had it all set up, and they brought her in order to trap Jesus. It's something like the story of the coin that the people bring to Jesus and say, should we pay taxes or not? And you're either way, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And so in this case, if he says, go ahead and stone her, then he's breaking the Roman law, which gave the power of the capital punishment to the Roman government, and that's all. And if he said, don't stone her, then he was also trapped, because then he would appear as a rabbi who wasn't very keen on the law and the punishment that goes with the law. And so Jesus finds his way through both of these traps and walks right through. And how does he do it? Well, first of all, he bends down and he says, if there is one of you who has not sinned, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. No, he first starts right on the ground. And we don't know what he wrote. Does anyone have an idea of what he might have written? We don't have any evidence, you know. There's no magic formula to tell us what he wrote.
Whatever it was, it must have been a prelude to the following story.
Yeah.
And he must have written something there that pricked the conscience of the... Of those who had brought the woman to judgment.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that might have been.
Well, he might have written exactly what he said. Okay? If there is one of you who has not sinned, let him be the first to cast a stone at her. And he could have written that in the sand. We don't know exactly what it was, and it's intriguing to imagine what it might have been. But then notice, yes? Yeah. And then notice, after he says that, then he starts writing again, so that he doesn't have to stand there and watch people leave. And it makes it easier for them, if they're going to leave, to walk away.
The thought occurred to me that maybe he wrote something to the effect that we find in Matthew 1:3. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites.
Yeah. He might have said that too. A lot of things he could have said. But the point is that the people who probably left first were the older, that is the elders of the group, because they would have been held responsible if this stoning had taken place. And some of them probably were relieved that it didn't take place, but some of them were probably uncomfortable with this kind of punishment. They trapped this woman. And they had it all set up, and there was no trial and no hearing, and so it was really a lynching. And some of them were probably uncomfortable with that, so they slip away. And gradually everyone goes away, because nobody can say, none of the men can say, that they have not imagined the possibility of adultery in their minds, and therefore none of them are innocent. And then when they've all gone, Jesus says, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir. Neither do I condemn you. Go away and don't sin anymore. So he's not giving forgiveness, and she's not asking for forgiveness. But he's saying, I don't condemn you, and don't do it anymore. And I'm sure that her life was changed as a result of that, and she could have actually been a Mary Magdalene or somebody like that who eventually becomes very significant in Jesus' life. We don't have a name for her. But it's also important to notice that it's usually the women who get leaned on. Where's the man? He's not brought in with her. You know. And so it's usually the women who bear the brunt of this sort of criticism. Okay? Any more comments about that? We have to move along rather quickly. Would someone read from chapter 9? Verse 1 down to 12, and then someone else pick it up at 13 and read over to 38. Would you? Go ahead.
As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night comes when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." As he said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and anointed the man's eyes with the clay, saying to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar said, "Is not this the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He said, "I am the man." And they said to him, "How then were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, "I do not know."
All right, someone else? All right.
They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. The Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" There was a division among them, so they again said to the blind man, "What do you say about him since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself." His parents said this because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess him to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So for the second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you too want to become his disciples?" And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is a marvel. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out.
Okay. This is the sixth sign that Jesus has done. And let's take a look at the signs that he's already done. Note that he has, we had the original one, which was that he created wine out of water. And the second one then, the second one is the healing of the Herodian judge's son, and then you get a story of the man at the pool of Bethesda being healed, and you get the miracle of bread in chapter 6, where he creates bread for enough people, and the miracle of presence, the walking on water, and the miracle of sight, now this one, and the miracle of life in chapter 11, where he raises Lazarus. And so it's a progression from lesser to greater. The other point to make is that Jesus has several purposes here. One is to show how light comes to people. That is how people are converted. John is sitting down taking a look at all the evidence that he could have put forth, all the evidence, all the events of Jesus' life, and he says, this one helps us to know how people come to faith, how the light dawns in people. And so he tells a story about a man who was very courageous and spoke up for himself, and he talks to the Pharisees very courageously. He doesn't have anything to lose. He was blind, and now he can see, and he says it. Well, you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? That's obviously sarcastic. For him to speak in this way to the powerful leaders of his country was a dramatic evidence of strength and power and his love for God. He doesn't care where the chips fall. He's going to tell his story no matter what. And when his parents are called in, they back away also. They say very clearly, we know he's our son and we know he was born blind, but we don't know how it is that he can see. Go and ask him. So this is a dramatic confrontation between people who have seen something and heard something and believe it and the leadership of their country. And it's almost takes your breath away to realize that these people are willing to speak in this way to the Pharisees. How can a sinner produce signs like this? You know? So the second question is, why do the innocent suffer? And Jesus, of course, starts off with the question, who sinned, this man or his parents, for him to be born blind? And Jesus responds, neither he nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that the works of God might be displayed in him. At the first session this morning, one of the members of the group, Dean Peterson, who is the speaker on Africa, said that this is a dramatic sign of what it means to talk about the love of God. We can't say that one sinned and therefore he gets punishment, or that the parent sinned and therefore the child is born blind or handicapped, but that all of the sin and the death and the trouble and illness is all a collection of things that result in certain circumstances. And God breaks through those circumstances and creates healing where it is his will. And you can't say that, you can say, of course, that he was born so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And so it's that God might show his power in this way. And he is the Lord over all. And so he uses this set of circumstances to create healing and hope for all. And notice the contrast between this person and the one we dealt with in chapter 5. In chapter 5, the man doesn't even say thank you to Jesus. He seems to be bewildered by the whole experience. And he goes immediately and cooperates with Jesus' enemies. But this man takes his responsibility and he says, this happened and I'm telling you what happened. So if you want to charge somebody, you can charge me. And his parents also speak up in a very dramatic way. And so it's a fascinating story. There are all kinds of possibilities. The use of spittle or spit is interesting. It's been said down through the years that the spittle of a man, particularly a famous man, would have miraculous power. And so Jesus uses a little bit of spit and he creates mud and he puts it on the man's eyes. And then he gives the man a job. He says, now you go down to the pool of Siloam and wash it off and then you will be able to see. And sure enough, that's what happens. So a little later, when the man comes back, and is talking with Jesus, how could he possibly know who Jesus is because he hasn't seen him? Anybody have a thought on that? How can he know who Jesus is if he hasn't seen him? Because he goes away, and then by the time he comes back, Jesus has disappeared and is walking some other part of the temple.
You don't have to have eyes to see your thoughts. See for you.
Yeah?
I mean, he experienced it. He knew it was a person.
Yeah? What did he experience?
The return of sight that he never had.
And what did he... He heard Jesus, didn't he?
Right.
So he knew the voice. So it's Jesus' voice that helps him to recognize it.
Here in the 35th verse of it, Jesus found him in the temple.
Yeah.
So here's one of those things where the hound of heaven speaks out to him.
Yeah. But I thought that was an insight, that he would have known who Jesus was by the sound of his voice.
Probably so.
Yeah.
The blind have that particular sense, and more acutely and more developed.
That's right. No question about that. Yeah. And, okay. Any more comments about that section? I want to spend the bulk of our time on chapter 11, because that's the dramatic turning point in this whole story. Chapter 11, would someone read for us from 1 down to 27?
Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness is not unto death, it is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by means of it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this he said to the disciples, let us go into Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were but now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. Thus he spoke, and then he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awake him out of sleep. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciple, let us also go, that we may die with him. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary sat in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God. He is coming into the world.
Okay, would somebody pick it up there? 28?
And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord." Once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there's a bad odor, for he's been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go."
Okay, thank you. The question is, if this is such a dramatic story, and if this is such a powerful thing, that it seems to be the reason, according to John, why his enemies begin to take action against him, and we'll come to that in a little while, then why isn't it in the synoptic accounts? And the only answer I've come up with that makes any sense is that this was probably part of the tradition that developed around Jerusalem, and that possibly John, the disciple of John now, the disciple of Jesus, whose name was John, has collected the material, and the way he presents the story, this is the event that triggers Jesus' arrest and his death. And that Peter is not mentioned in the story, you notice, and Peter may not have been there at this point, and therefore it's not part of the tradition that Peter passed on to his people. You have to remember that this wasn't an organized business. The disciples started telling the story of Jesus, and they expected him to return rather soon. And so they didn't expect to have to write it down and organize it and so on, at least not right away. And as they tell the story and they go off in different directions, then you find a different tradition developing around each person. And so it's quite possible that Peter didn't know this story, or if he heard it, he didn't give it as much importance because he didn't see it. I don't know, but that seems to be the only reason why such a dramatic story would not be in the Synoptic Gospels. At any rate, you know that Mary and Martha now are very good friends of Jesus, and so was Lazarus. He comes to Bethany, and he rests with them regularly. Every time he comes to Jerusalem, he stops in their house. That seems to have been the case. And so there was a very close relationship, and John makes reference to the fact in verse 2 that this Mary, the sister of Lazarus, who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair. That's the event that's coming up in chapter 13. So you see that this was a very close relationship. These people loved each other very much. And then when Jesus hears the story, you notice that they don't ask him to come. Okay? Mary and Martha don't say, "Please come." They just say, "He is sick." And they assume that if he hears that, he will immediately come to visit them. And Jesus then deliberately waits. He waits 2 days so that the body will have been dead, the person will have been dead for 4 days by the time he gets there. And that will mean that the spirit of the person has left. The Jews believed that the spirit would remain with the body for 3 days. And after the fourth day, then, of course, the person is really totally dead. No question about it. And so they, so Jesus wants to be sure that there's no question about it. This man was dead, and he's going to make sure that that happens. And then the disciples, of course, wonder about going back. I mean, there's been all this opposition and this trouble, and do they really want to get back into that again? And so they say, it's not long since the Jews wanted to stone you, and you should read that word Judeans. This is not all the Jews, because Jesus himself is a Jew. And to translate that Jews is to give the blame to all the people. And that's caused a lot of trouble over the centuries. But the way to get around it is to say this word should be translated Judeans. And of course the original Greek, Judaioi, can be translated both ways. And it makes a lot more sense to say Judeans. Okay? That the Judeans wanted to stone you. Are you going back again? And then Jesus says, yes, I'm going back. And then, who is it says? Then Thomas, in verse 16, says, he said to the other disciples, let us go to and die with him. And that seems to be the style of Thomas. He tends to be a rather negative person. Remember, he's the one at the end of John's Gospel who says, I won't believe unless I put my hand into his wounds and see his hands, and so on. So that's the same character, okay? Let us go to and die with him. They're ready to face whatever is coming. So Jesus arrives there, and he's now facing the situation where Lazarus has been dead for 4 days, and you get the note that Bethany's only about 2 miles. Remember, this is different from the Bethany beyond the Jordan, which where John had been baptizing. And many Jews had come to Mary and Martha to sympathize with him. And Martha now, in character with her leadership role, remember the story of Mary and Martha in the Gospel of Luke. Martha's the one who speaks up. And she says, and this is kind of a mild rebuke, because they were very close. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. And that was a rebuke to Jesus for not coming immediately. And so Jesus has to recognize that. But I know that even now, whatever you ask of God, he will grant you. That if you ask that he be healed, he can be healed. And this is, in according to Jan, our Bible study teacher last week, she says this is the equivalent of the statement that Peter made at Caesarea Philippi, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that's John's way of presenting that material. Your brother, and then Jesus responds, your brother will rise again. And then Martha says, I know that he will rise again at the resurrection on the last day. So that's a hope that many Jews had. I am the resurrection and the life. So we get another of Jesus' I ams. You know, there were 7 of them. 7 is the complete number. I am the resurrection and the life. If anyone believes in me, even though he dies, he will live. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And she says she does. But then later she seems to deny that because she hesitates at the point when Jesus is about to call Lazarus out. But we'll get to that in a minute. And then she goes to call her sister Mary. And Mary, of course, says the same thing. You know, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. So she's also rebuking Jesus. And then you get a statement that's very interesting. At the sight of her tears and those of the Jews who followed her, Jesus said in great distress, with a sigh that came straight from the heart. Whenever I pick up a new Bible that I haven't seen before, a new translation, I look for this verse. Because that word, and the original Greek is emprimaomai, It's a very difficult word to translate, and it has a number of different meanings which you have to put together in the context. And I'll give you some examples of how it's translated. Deeply agitated in spirit, shook with emotion, moved with indignation, deeply troubled, visibly distressed, shuddered, moved with deepest emotion, groaned deeply, was troubled, raged at his own spirit, tormented himself, groaned in spirit, and was troubled. All those are possible translations of that one word. So you see that it's a difficult word to translate. But one of the elements that seems to me that's essential is the element of anger. Jesus is angry. He is upset. He's troubled. But he's also in part angry. Now, who could he be angry with? He could be angry at the power of death, that God or death has taken his good friend. And this makes him angry. But he's also very upset and very troubled because of all the confused emotions that he must have had. This was not just another person. This was not just somebody he came to on the road, like he raised up the widow of Nain's son. You remember that event from the Synoptic Gospels. But this is somebody that he knew, a good friend that he had many earnest conversations with, maybe even late into the evening. And this man is dead. And his sisters are very upset, and they are even mildly rebuking him for what has happened. And so he becomes very upset, and he weeps. The shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. And so you recognize how deeply Jesus felt about the situation. And then you get the criticism, he opened the eyes of the blind man, could he not have prevented this man's death? So there were some who were there who were negative. And always you have an audience, don't you? Some who believe in him and some who criticize him. And that seems to go on from the beginning of the gospel right down to the end. And then he goes to the tomb and he says, take the stone away. And then Martha says, Lord, by now he will smell. This is the fourth day. And so Martha seems to have some question about whether Jesus can in fact raise a person from death. And so she kind of hesitates. And Jesus replies, have I not told you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? And by the way, the glory of God is a theme that runs all the way through the Gospel of John. The glory of God will be revealed ultimately in Jesus' cross and resurrection. And constantly there's reference to the glory of God. The glory of God is the power of God at work in this life. And God can work through in all kinds of ways wonderful things. And John insists that it's the glory of God all the way through. And that's the reason that he doesn't have some of the evidence that is in the Synoptic Gospels. And you don't see John presenting Jesus as the suffering servant so much as you see him rising above and challenging every situation, because he is the glorified Son of God, and he speaks and walks through all of these situations with a marvelous sense of his own identity and what will happen. Last night they were showing the last temptation of Christ in the next room, and I ducked in for a little while. And one of my criticisms of that movie, although I went to see it myself and I don't agree with all the fierce criticism that has gone on, is that it presents Jesus in too hesitant a way. And he hesitates when he says things, and he's not sure about things. And the Gospel of John is anything but that. I mean, the Jesus of John is somebody who strides through and takes charge of every situation. He knows what he wants to do, and he does it. And there's no question about it. So that's a picture. The last temptation of Christ presents Jesus in a way that is very hesitant and very unsure. And John is anything but that. So they didn't get the evidence for that picture out of out of the Gospel of John, because that's a mark of his story. Well, anyway, he calls Lazarus to come out, and Lazarus, of course, cannot walk, okay? So the only way he could have gotten out was to kind of wiggle his way out and stumble out. And gradually, because at the end Jesus says, unbind him, let him go free. Because he would have been, his whole body would have been bound with these strips of cloth, and his face would have been covered, and there would have been a linen cloth over his face and his head, and he wouldn't have been able to move very well. So the only way he could have gotten out would be to kind of work his way out, stumble and get out in whatever way he could. Well, it's a dramatic evidence of Jesus' power to heal. Yes?
As many times as I've read this, I just saw something that I hadn't picked up on before. Martha and Mary and Lazarus must have been rather singular people, because one would assume that the people that were grieving in the house, the Jews who were in the house consoling her, might also have been friends of Jesus, since they were close friends of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus.
That's right.
And that they, the Jews who came with her also weeping.
Yeah.
Is another phrase. But then you get down to 45 and it says, many of those Jews therefore who had come with Mary and seen what he did, but some of them went to the Pharisees.
Both sides.
Yeah.
Both. And the thing goes, yes.
When you mentioned that the Judeans that crucified or promoted the crucifixion of Christ, and putting, rather than some of the other Jewish circles, but still in our Christianity of the Western world and also the other countries, we are reminded that because of being human, we are part of the crucifixion of Christ.
That's right, that's right. We're all part of it. Yeah? He died for us. Yeah? Thank you. That's a very important part of the story.
That's why daily we need to think about the crucifixion and point our...
Repent every day.
Resurrection.
That's right, that's right. Yes?
I think to following that along, on a personal basis, we actually are crucifying ourselves. We are killing ourselves by not letting that part of ourselves be born that is meant to be born. Mm-hmm. So we have denied God his commission of creation. So maybe this is the biggest heresy, not all of the moral and ethical violations that we commit, but this is the fact that we don't permit him to be born in us. So we crucify him, and we don't let him be born within ourselves.
Okay.
That's something that happened 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, Alice.
In Galatians 2:20, one of my favorite verses, I am crucified with Christ, yet I live. The eyes play an important part, and that is the ego, the big ego, and the little ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
this
right.
is why that in pagan, or not really pagan, but such as in the Philippines, self-righteous.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, even though the churches are trying to stop it in the thoughts and minds of both people, they feel they need to partake of that.
Yeah. That's part of the mentality of the Filipinos.
Right.
That's right. I've heard that. Yeah.
Move it all. It springs up every week.
Right, right. I'd like to spend a minute talking about funerals, because one of the things I learned when I lived in Japan for all those years is that the Japanese have their own way of dealing with death. And they often, in fact, most of the time, have a funeral in the home. And so you can't escape it. You can't say, well, we had the funeral over there in the funeral home, or we had the funeral over there in the church. The person died in the house, and therefore the funeral should be held there. In the first place, they didn't have funeral homes, and they still don't have very many funeral homes. They have funeral directors who work with it. But what it brings home to me is the fact that it has to be real. You have to accept the fact that your loved one has died. And in America, we have certain situations that develop every once in a while where the person has lost someone, but they haven't really dealt with it. And so you get a delayed grief syndrome, whereby the person goes on and they haven't really dealt with the fact that they've lost someone significant to them. And you get all kinds of symptoms of people who haven't finished dealing with the death of their loved one. The most dramatic case of that I had was one time we went over the mountains to another pastor, to his home and to the church where he worked. And his father, I think it was, had died. And they were having the funeral in the church. And as soon as the funeral was over, it was a wooden casket. They put the lid on the casket and they hammered nails into the casket. And I never felt the finality of death as much as that time. Bang, bang, bang. You know, you can't get away with it. You can't get away from it. It's there and you have to deal with it. And so you don't have delayed grief syndrome among the Japanese.
Well, that's why in the Spanish countries, Mexico is a good example, that they revere the place of death.
Uh-huh.
That's why along the highways and that, the little crosses and flowers, they come every so often. That's where they lost their child or their son or their spouse.
Okay, okay.
And that's revered and always taken care of the family. So.
Yeah. Someone else have a question? Yes, Alice.
So often children are not taken to a funeral, you know, even of a parent.
Yeah, right, right.
So evident in Kennedy's death and burial that all the children were involved.
Yeah.
And
I was not allowed to be taken to my own father's funeral, and I've always regretted that. But customs have changed a little bit since those days. Yes?
There at the end of the session, I must relate to a story. A young pastor went to a church that was a very dead church, hardly anybody was left, even the membership. And so he had an idea, which turned out to be a very, very significant idea. He posted a notice in the paper that a very prominent person that died and the funeral would be in this church. Of course, she didn't give any name. So naturally, a small community and the church was full of people, and the casket down in front gave the sermon of what we're talking about. At the end of the sermon, he goes down and opens the lid, says, "Now you want to file down and greet the departed." And there was a mirror down in the casket. As each one looked down, they saw themselves. I must say that he had a big congregation from that on.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Dramatic way to do it. That's right. Any other comments?
I'm wondering about the Jesus weeping here, if that might not be an indication of God's empathy for our grief. It was, I suppose we can all look at death as being kind of academic, but it doesn't touch us directly.
Yeah.
But these people he cared about were certainly going through a lot of grief, and it seems to me that perhaps Jesus being deeply touched by not so much Lazarus's death, because he knew he could take care of that, but the grief he saw these people going through.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Psalm 20, I will weep when you are weeping.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. Like you said in your devotions this morning. Yeah. Or you sang that too. But yeah, that's exactly right. That's the hope that we have, is that when we are grieving, Jesus grieves with us. And when we are unhappy, he is unhappy with us. And when we are happy, he's happy with us.
that's the biggest thing, that you get the results of working, you know, mission field is they keep telling you that you're willing to come here and share our grief,
yeah,
for our
yeah. That's right.
That was also kind of interesting, the difference between Martha and Mary, almost a reprise of the incident at the home with the dinner. Martha apparently just approaches him and does sound like she rebukes him, but says Mary falls at his feet. And rather sounds to me less like a rebuke than a, oh, if only you've been here.
Mm-hmm. Can be read that way too.
Lord.
Yeah, that's right. And that seems to be the difference in the temperament of those two women. Martha was the more active, the more direct person, and Mary is the more emotional, the more quiet.
Even though they said the same words, I would think.
Might have said them in a different way.
Content was probably different.
Right, right. Very good, very good. Thank you. Okay. For tomorrow, would you read from chapter 12, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. We can't cover it all, but I'm hoping that you will have time to read that much, and then we will, that'll be the fourth session, and that leaves us 18 to 21 for the last, the passion and suffering and death. But if you take 12 through 17. Okay, thank you.